Welcome to today's program titled Protecting Trade Secrets and Intellectual Property in Business Transactions. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. For those of you who are logged into the web presentation, you are encouraged to submit questions throughout the conference by selecting the chat pod located in the lower left corner of your screen. Then type and send your question that way. This presentation has been prepared by Seyfarth Shaw LLP for informational purposes only and is not legal advice. This information is not intended to create, and receipt of it does not constitute an attorney-client relationship. Participants should not act upon this information without seeking professional counsel. The material discussed during this webinar should not be construed as legal advice or legal opinion on any specific facts or circumstances. The content is intended for general information purposes only, and you are urged to consult a lawyer concerning your own situation and any specific legal questions you may have. Any tax information or written tax advice contained herein, including any attachments, is not intended to be and cannot be used by any taxpayer for the purpose of avoiding tax penalties that may be imposed on the taxpayer. For those of you who are interested in obtaining CLE credit for this webinar, an attendance verification code will be read during the presentation. The code will be required on the CLE attendance affirmation form sent with the login information email. Please write this code down. It will not be reread, and it is required for CLE credit. If you would like a copy of today's presentation, you may download it from the Handouts tab under the Conference Materials pod. At this time, I'd like to turn it over to our speakers, Randy Brookmiller, Michael Baniak, and Michael Wexler. You may now begin.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, and good morning to those of you on the West Coast. This is Mike Baniak coming to you from somewhat chilly Chicago, and we have Randy Brookmiller, coming from a little warmer Houston down there. Hey, Randy?
That's right. We've got probably a little bit warmer weather than you guys up there.
Yeah. Well, today we have a feast in the sense of all of the materials that, well, first we have somebody that knows how to operate this. A feast at year end, kind of a smorgasbord of materials. And like any good feast, we probably won't be able to finish, you know, what we have here. But we'll progress through what we're going to talk about in terms of today's topics. As you see, how to properly address developments by independent contractors. We're not going to take them in this order, but you know, this is what we're going to try to cover in today's session. So first we'll talk about joint ventures, as a matter of fact, IP rights and the life of a joint venture. That's kind of an appetizer, shall we say, a little short one to begin with. We'll talk about integrating and binding key employees regarding confidential information. And then we'll get to IP due diligence and mergers and acquisitions. So you can see we have quite a variety of material to try to get through today. And first, as I said, a little stop at a joint venture. Just kind of setting forth, you know, joint ventures will typically result where you have two parties that each may be capable of bringing something to the party, shall we say, in terms of product development or some kind of technology, you know, something that either of them cannot do on their own. They've sought each other out. One may have sought the other out for its talents and what it may have in the way of technology. Let's consider, for example, a hypothetical. You've got this scenario. Acme has a flavoring business. It sells, you know, flavoring compounds. Then we have another company, Roadrunner, has a genetically altered yeast. That's what they do. They genetically alter products, and they have this genetically altered yeast. Well, Acme comes to Roadrunner and says it wants to team up for making vats of flavoring using the genetically altered yeast. So what we end up with is a situation where Not getting the next slide here, Nicole. So there. Nope. We want to go back one. So what we're going to be dealing with is a situation where you have to figure out, and this is, you know, we jump to the end here, all before the joint venture begins, because you don't want to be going down this path and suddenly discovering what it is that you didn't plan for, didn't think about along the way. But you want to sort out what the pre-existing rights are of the intellectual property of each party. You know, plainly, Acme has this technology, has this flavoring business, which it wants to expand upon. Roadrunner has the genetically altered yeast, which it would like to expand upon and provide that yeast to Acme for, you know, this joint venture, which is probably going to result typically in a new company, NewCo, being formed as a result of, you know, the parties teaming up on this. So we have, you know, technology that each party has. It could be technology that is essentially patentable or patented, and we have technology that is trade secret, confidential information, know-how, show-how, such as how the genetically altered yeast comes to be. So in the beginning, as we're sorting this out, we have to determine what each party needs to protect in the way of its technology, because it's going to be sharing this technology with at least the joint venture that is going to be created to commercialize this technology. Doesn't necessarily have to be a new company. That's perhaps the easiest and more simple way to deal with the technology that's going to result and to deal with compartmentalizing what each party is going to provide. But it could be that this is just going to be something that Acme is going to run with because it's in the business of providing flavorings. These are the kind of issues that you have to figure out and determine, you know, from the outset. And it becomes fairly complex even in, you know, a simple kind of hors d'oeuvre type situation that we're talking about here. So what you do is you sort out and say, this is what we're going to provide and this is how we're going to protect, you know, our existing technology. The joint venture then is going to get some rights as a result of that, because the joint venture is going to need that in order to commercialize whatever it is that's going to be created. These rights could, you know, result in something that's potentially patentable. So the question is going to be, do we patent it or don't we patent it? That has aspects to it, especially if there are trade secrets involved that, you know, will be exposed if they end up being published in a patent application. And the question is going to be, who pays for, you know, the filing and prosecution of, you know, these patent applications? The question is going to be, who is going to own what results, you know, in terms of what it is that's going to be created? We're assuming there's a new creation that's going to occur along the way. This, you know, genetically altered yeast, which is now cranking out some kind of flavorings. Is it going to be solely Acme? Since Acme is the only one in this business, it's not Roadrunner that's in this business. So that's a question to address and, you know, to answer at the outset again. Roadrunner, of course, wants to protect its yeast technology, so then it's going to try to keep that bottled up somehow, some way, so that rights don't flow over and get loose in the future from, for example, the relationship breaking down. That's what we always have to kind of prepare for, which is there's going to be at some point in the future when the parties are going to part, and the joint venture may live on its own or it may not. And then you have to decide what are the rights that are going to exist into the future. It's not as if the joint venture is just going to stop dead. It could happen, but unlikely it's going to happen. So then the question is going to be non-exclusive licenses. You know, what licenses need the joint venture have in order to continue on into the future, regardless of whether Acme is still around, whether Roadrunner is still around? Are these rights going to be non-transferable, for example, because perhaps we, you know, trust the joint venture that we've created and the parties that we put in charge of that joint venture, but, you know, as to transferability, that may not be something that's in the cards. Are there going to be non-competes? For example, if, you know, Acme is the company that is going to be running with this modified, you know, yeast flavoring, is Acme going to want to assure that it's not going to see any competition from someone such as Roadrunner? as the relationship devolves into the future, or, you know, the parties just go their separate ways and the JV continues. It's going to be questions concerning the JV itself. Who controls it? Who's going to have the board elected? These are all complex issues which, you know, all need to be sorted out in terms of protecting your intellectual property that, you know, goes into the joint venture. So as I said, this is kind of an hors d'oeuvre. Now we'll switch and let Randy take over.
Yeah, so one of the things you want to think about, you know, in this context or just in general, really, when you're dealing with, you know, sensitive information like this is employment agreements, confidentiality agreements, things of that nature. And it's the usual scenario where, you know, for executive, high-level managers, those type of folks that most companies at this point in time, you know, definitely have agreements, detailed agreements in place with those types of employees. But, you know, what's forgotten many times is some of those mid-level employees or lower-level employees that inevitably do come in contact with the confidential information that you're trying to protect. And so the thing there to remember is you must take measures to protect that information in order to have protection later when you go to court to try to get injunctive relief or pursue a cause of action to protect that information or get damages for improper use of it. And the reason is because in order for it to be a trade secret or be considered a trade secret under the law, reasonable measures must have been taken by the company to protect the information. You also have confidential information itself, aside from trade secret information, that you need to take careful care to protect as well. And as we get through the next several slides, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But the gist here is simply that you must take measures in your employment agreements to protect the information, and not just through, you know, agreements with executives and high levels, but many of the lower level employees, because as it says here, eliminate the weakest link. Sometimes, you know, you've got somebody very low on the chain that inevitably will be working with that information and could easily walk out the door with it if there's no protections in place, with some limitations, of course. But the best practice, of course, is to have an appropriate employment agreement in place.
One thing that Randy and I talked about in preparation for this is, you know, this weakest link aspect. You have all different kinds of employees, you know, up the food chain, which will have access to some, perhaps all of the trade secrets. So in many instances, we think about those at the highest level, you know, who have a really good understanding, who may have been involved in the creation and the evolution of the technology. The trade secret information, the proprietary information. But then there are the people that are actually hands-on, you know, the third shift workers and all, who are there preparing the formulations and who have access to the standard operating procedures. Oftentimes, they are basically forgotten in this chain as to, you know, what it is that they know and can walk off with potentially. So that's kind of the weakest link, and Randy will tell us more about that.
Yeah, so in creating these agreements, there's more than simply a sentence or two about, you know, you can't use or disclose our confidential information and having them sign off on that. You know, you can get much more in depth, and depending upon the level of an employee, you may have more stuff or less stuff, you know, as far as non-competes involving customers, clients, suppliers, non-solicit agreements. Sometimes people refer to non-solicit of customers and group them into that. We generally throw into the category of non-competes. But another thing for non-solicitation is non-solicitation of other employees once they leave. There's many instances where that has become a very big problem for certain companies when a large group of employees migrate altogether because of one high-level manager, mid-level manager, or even a lower-level employee convinced everybody to go to a competitor and help move people over, and that can be a huge problem. So you want to have those things in the agreement as appropriate. And IP assignment, where you definitely have to have some provisions in the agreement whereby the employee assigns any IP developed in the course of the employment. Of course, it needs to be reasonably related to what the company is doing, but nevertheless, you need to have those provisions in there. And then some other provisions that are, completely unrelated to the IP, such as choice of form and forum selection clauses, things of that nature, while they seem collateral and not that big of a deal on the front end, when you get to the point of trying to enforce these agreements, they become a very big deal because the forum where you're litigating whatever it is and whatever law controls can have an astronomical impact as far as whether or not you're going to be successful with your lawsuit. So all of those provisions need to be appropriately addressed. Another thing, once you do get your agreements in place, one thing that you have to stay on top of and have to always keep in mind is that it's inevitable that as time goes on, there's going to be changes in the law. And so the venues or states wherever you have employees is always important to check at least on an annual basis to see, what changes have taken place in the law that suddenly our non-competes there are no longer enforceable because we had the wrong type of consideration, or the geographic boundaries or the way that we set out the whatever it was the area they're not to compete in has suddenly become an incorrect way to set up those provisions, and so we have to change it. And so it's important to check periodically, annually at the very least is the best way to do that. Another issue is consideration. For example, in Texas, money is not adequate consideration. In other venues, it's just fine. In fact, it's the preferred consideration for non-competes in certain states. And there's other things that go in as well. Such as, sometimes when employees get promoted, they have to have a new non-compete in certain states. In other states, it's not a problem. It's no big deal. And so, it just varies from state to state. And, you can have a general form non-competes and general form agreements that if structured appropriately, you can probably use in most states with a few exceptions. But those are all very important considerations to think about on the front end, because when it becomes a big deal and everybody's pointing fingers is on the back end when all of a sudden, some very key employees have walked out the door and lo and behold, the agreements in place are not the right agreements to restrict those folks appropriately. And so then it becomes a big deal and a big problem.
I want to seize on a little item here, Randy, and that is those key employees. What we have here is a potential inconsistency over the evolution of these agreements. The employment agreements are not necessarily cookie cutter type. Sometimes they are. But when you're dealing with people who've been in the industry for a while and, who are going into a high-level position, a high-level engineering position, there's going to be potentially some negotiation that's going to occur. That changes the agreements, it changes certain clauses in the agreements, and you can see a kind of a drift that occurs. And in, in trying to enforce various agreements, that drift and those inconsistencies now can potentially cause, heartburn, trouble later on, where you have one agreement that says, certain things are trade secret confidential, and then another agreement which seems to define it a little differently. So those are things that, as Randy indicated, you really do need to go back and continue to visit this and try to establish as much as possible some homogeneity in these agreements. Back to you, Randy.
Okay. Let's see. Move on to our next slide. Of course, here with your IP assignment agreements, simple, straightforward. you know, these things, as long as they're drafted appropriately, can really cover your bases and really not be near as much of a headache as your non-competes and things like that. In fact, it is extremely rare that you ever get any kind of employee pushback on these type of provisions whenever you're getting an employee to sign an employment agreement. In fact, whether it's been good luck or what, I've never had an employee raise this particular raise an issue with the IP assignment clause whenever they're signing that, at the beginning of their employment or sometime, you know, along the way. It's always, if there's any heartburn, it's usually over the non-compete, things of that nature. So, you know, draft it appropriately, and, you know, it's something that you can sort of put in the rearview mirror at least for a while, so long as you've done appropriately, and probably don't have to haggle much with the employees over. Mike, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, in general, you see very little pushback because somebody is hired to invent, for example, and they understand that and they understand how the world works, which is, you know, by common law, those inventions are going to belong to the employer in all 50 states anyway. But what you do see sometimes is if you have an independent inventor, somebody who's been out inventing on his or her own for a while, and then you bring that party into your organization, sometimes they get a little prickly over what it is that, you know, they think they may be providing in the way of inventions going forward. So, you know, there may be some negotiation. I've seen that happen with respect to, you know, those kind of new employees. Back to you, Randy.
Okay. You know, on your IP assignment agreements, major issue is really the scope of what you're trying to cover with the agreement, and it has to be reasonably related to the business. If the business is in the business of doing one thing, you can't turn around and make an assignment of essentially anything this person were to invent that's completely and totally unrelated to the business. That won't work. So you need to keep the scope appropriate.
Some states actually have a statute. Their statute's directed to that very issue, which, you know, lays out that, you know, the employee will own the invention unless, you know, it relates to the business of the company or the contemplated business. That's sometimes where, you know, a company can get itself in trouble, where it's trying to, you know, say, well, wait, we were thinking about getting into, you know, that type of technology versus, you know, well, we definitely had plans to do it, and you can see the concrete plans. So sometimes you have to put in, time provisions in terms of, well, the company gets into it within 6 months of the employee's departure or, you know, a year after. Some of those clauses need to be considered to capture things that the company may be considering. The company's business can evolve over time, too. So what was once its business 5 years ago may no longer be its business and may be the employee's invention. So these are issues that do flex and flow over time.
Right. Back to employment agreements a little bit more. As far as the distinction between trade secrets and confidential information, that distinction is something that is important and something to keep in mind when doing employment agreements. First off, trade secrets, as far as the duration goes, they're going to be the company's trade secrets for a very long time and far beyond the foreseeable future in most cases. Regular old confidential information, though, that doesn't rise to the level of a trade secret, that information probably becomes stale at some point. And, in the agreements itself, something that gives the agreement a little more credibility is to perhaps limit the time at which the confidential information, something that's merely confidential information as opposed to trade secrets, is protected, a certain number of years or something of that nature. You know, and as we mentioned a little bit already, you know, got to stay really on top of the non-compete provisions as it relates to from state to state. There's such significant differences now in many states, and some states that have traditionally been very pro-employee as it relates to non-competes have gone very pro-employer. For instance, Texas in the last 10 years has moved from a sort of in the middle of the road to a very pro-employer. Georgia, another state that a few years ago had some significant changes that moved that state into the very pro-employer category. Illinois, on the other hand, you know, has some case law out there now as far as, you know, employees have to be with the company a certain period of time in some situations, you know, as far as consideration issue goes. So, you know, in big picture, it's hard to crystal ball exactly where the law is going to be over the long haul. And so you've got to think about, you know, how what's the best way to draft the agreement in such a way that it will sort of catch different scenarios that may come into play as far as legal changes, you know, as far as mentioning that your consideration is more than just money or more than just confidential information, and it's, you know, and continued employment and so forth and so on, and listing a number of things so that when that law change does happen down the road, you still got a good agreement in place. Because what happens a lot of times is you've got an employee that came into the company 20 years ago as the very low-level employee, but over the last 20 years has migrated and worked their way up through the system and maybe not be high enough up to be a high-level manager whereby the company has really sat down and made them sign a new agreement. And in some cases may have that the only agreement they have in place with the company is that one they signed 20 years ago. And in that situation, hopefully that one signed 20 years ago was drafted appropriately and somebody has sort of eyeballed it along the way as a part of a big group of agreements that may or may not have been needed to be tweaked. And hopefully it's fine. But, you know, it's important to think about it in that context, that what these guys are – gals are signing on the front end is something that may or may not be a problem, you know, way down the road.
Sorry, kind of anecdotally here, I've got a file that is just full of copies of employment agreements that I've known and loved over the years. And I look back at some of these that are 15, 20 years old, which were totally enforceable and totally acceptable then. And I look at provisions that, you know, today, no, there's no way that provision would necessarily fly. And then you have to deal with certain issues that there's just no way to necessarily deal with it. And that is, you know, you're in North Carolina and you're drafting employee agreements for your employees there. And then, you know, the employee leaves, goes to California. And now you're trying to enforce, you know, some kind of a provision, restriction, whatever, you know, in California. And good luck with that.
That's right. No doubt. And that's another reason, that exact scenario is another reason why your choice of law and forum selection clauses and things like that are things to pay very close attention to as well on the front end, is because, you know, you never know how the law might evolve. And even California law has changed a little bit in the direction of where some of those clauses are now enforced. And even though your employee now has wound up in California, you may, lo and behold, have a way to still get them to not compete or you know, at least protect your information.
Now it comes the time when I give the code for those who are seeking CLE. And that code is SSSAMSAM1730. That code again, SS1730. To you, Randy.
Okay, next slide here. This is a quote from Posner, and basically the gist of it is simply, you know, the more time and money that the company spends to protect its information, the easier it is down the road to show in court that it is in fact a trade secret and something that will be harmful to the company if this employee or former employee, as it usually is allowed to walk out the door with it. So you're able to get over your legal hurdles much easier. You know, if you have an appropriate agreement in place and all the things that we've talked about, and in addition to that, that you've actually taken the time and spent the time and energy and money to protect the information. And next slide here is, you know, talks about proprietary information, and that's sort of a big picture, swallows up both your trade secrets and confidential information. And your confidential information, like we talked about, is more than just trade secrets. It can be other business technical know-how, show-how type information that doesn't necessarily rise to the level of a trade secret, but nevertheless is something that the company certainly does not want to be shared with the competitor and doesn't want to be just shared in the general public either. Even if it's not a trade secret, it may be something that would be harmful to the company if the information got out. So you don't want it out there. And again, confidential information does have a shorter shelf life than trade secrets, and that's just a natural product of the confidential information, at least as with the passage of time, generally becomes less important. This slide
In agreements, you don't typically sort this information out as to what's trade secret, you know, per se, and what else is confidential information. Although there may be some evidence in an agreement in terms of how you have set forth various information that way. Typically, we're not going to, you know, sift that at an early stage because some information can evolve from, you know, something that may have been considered just confidential to something that was trade secret and also, you know, can go in the other direction as well. So, you know, and one thing to think about, too, is, you know, we've all seen these ubiquitous NDAs, and they've been around certainly through all of my practice, 30-plus years, where, you know, it's a very short form, and then it says we're going to protect each other's confidential information, except for what's in the public domain, what, you know, may enter the public domain, what we already knew and by written records could show. But then oftentimes there's a little clause that's in there that says, oh, by the way, and all of these restrictions that we're putting on ourselves and the confidentiality and the non-use will terminate at the end of 2 years or 3 years, you know, whatever's written into the agreement. And I look at these things and I say, you know, seriously, really? Are you going to say that at the end of, you know, 2 year period from the termination of whatever, you're now able to use that information freely? So some of those ubiquitous agreements really have to be scrutinized a little harder, especially as to real life trade secrets.
That's right. Yeah. If it's a close call, you definitely don't want to include it in that provision of when stuff can, you know, be used because of the nature of it could evolve into just from being confidential information into actually being a trade secret. So, and this slide here is just another slide highlighting what we've talked about, and that is that trade secrets is really a small part generally of what is in the realm of confidential information. Confidential information, when defining it in your confidentiality agreements, is actually a great platform for you to be broad in the sense of think about it when you're, you know, fast forward to the situation where an employee's walked out the door and you've got to be down at the courthouse and we've got to be getting an injunction in place for you. It's much easier to get that injunction in place if the confidential information, there's an agreement there detailing out everything that's confidential. And oh, by the way, it actually includes exactly and mentions exactly what this employee has taken, you know, a price list or a customer list or one thing or another. You know, depending upon the situation, it's much easier to get that judge to give us that injunction that we're wanting, as opposed to something that's very brief and very narrow. Of course, you don't want to get too overly broad to where you really lose credibility in the language in the agreement, but at the same time, you can be broad enough, and by having that agreement, provide you much more protection than just simply have down there arguing, hey, this is our confidential information. They shouldn't be allowed to use it. They're on the other side saying, no, this is not really confidential. You know, this is no big deal. We could look on the internet and recreate this exact thing in 10 minutes. It's really not that big a deal. You know, you should just dismiss this. So, you know, drafting the language of the confidentiality provision can go a long way on those type of situations.
The standpoint of trade secrets too, that sweet spot in the previous slide that we had. I always try to counsel my clients that less is more with respect to what you consider to be your trade secrets, because you get into a trade secret dispute and the plaintiff, you know, immediately says everything is secret and everything, you know, is protectable. And that path is not a good path to take, because you're going to lose credibility very quickly when things, you know, don't turn out to be treated as confidential information versus, hey, you know, we're really taking care of the crown jewels here. And, you know, going back to that judge slide with the gavel, you know, we took the effort and we were protecting that technology, that proprietary information as, you know, our trade secrets, and we can show that. So consistency is extremely important when you're dealing with trade secrets, and that consistency has to be over time. You consistently protected the secrets in, you know, a reasonable manner, and we'll come to, you know, that in a moment. Well, Randy will talk about, you know, what are reasonable steps. So reverting now back to our little slideshow, you know, what is a trade secret?
Yeah, and so kind of adding to what Mike just said there, you know, one of the things that you can do is limiting the amount of employees that actually have access to certain information, such that only those that absolutely need certain high-level items that we actually consider trade secrets in one part of the business, only those folks have access to that. By doing that, that's just another way to show the courts, you know, that these are truly the crown jewels. These are the things that we've gone above and beyond to protect, and lo and behold, here's so-and-so taking them, this competitor or this other former employee or whatever it might be.
One quote I like to use, which is attributed to Benjamin Franklin, where he said, you know, three people can keep a secret as long as two of them are dead.
That's right. Okay, so a trade secret is one of the most elusive and difficult concepts in the law to define. And, you know, the gist there is that there is many things that weigh into this, and that is why there's so much argument in these cases where we're down there getting an injunction or defending against somebody trying to get an injunction, depending upon what the situation might be. You know, it depends on many things, you know, things that we've talked about as far as what reasonable efforts have been taken to keep the information secret. What is the value of the information? Are we truly talking about a big deal here, or are we talking about, you know, it looks more like you're just out to give this employee a hard time who's going to your competitor, and, you know, that this is not really about protection of your information, or is it? You know, is the information the type that actually gives the company an advantage over its competitors? You know, there's a lot of different things that go into what truly is a trade secret, and whether or not the court will ultimately conclude that it does fit in that category and therefore is something that should be given these protections that, if you're on the plaintiff side, you're asking for, you know, an injunction, as well as down the road damages for taking it, or is it not? And it's not something that you're going to get an injunction for, or if you do get an injunction, it's going to be so narrow that it's not of as much use. You know, the usual culprits that you're worried about, the most common is certainly former employees. That is the most common as far as cases that are filed and litigated. It's generally former employees have left, gone to a competitor. On the way out, they took significant information with them, whether it be on hard copy and a thumb drive, emailed it to their personal email, you know, or some other method to get the information out. You know, foreign competitors, especially, you know, companies that have somehow gotten a hold of your information that are in a foreign country, it's a big concern because the difficulty of trying to enforce an injunction on somebody in another country, especially certain countries that really do not observe anything going on in a court in the United States, you've got a big problem on your hands as far as what that company can then do with your information and your ability to stop it. On-site contractors, go ahead.
In terms of you know, cyber law, which is just burgeoning now and has, you know, perhaps over the past 10 or 15 years, you know, we're dealing with what, you know, many in the field refer to as a war, essentially, where you do have you know, foreign competitors, you have foreign governments, foreign mercenaries tapping into, you know, our websites and into our secure facilities, and, you know, taking out information, and it's happening all the time. So, you know, that is a huge concern, and it's something that, you know, you really do have to try to address as best one can. Not so much from the standpoint of, you know, people you have control over, like employees and people who come onto your facility, such as, you know, the vendors and suppliers, but, you know, a massive concern and the subject of a whole different seminar.
Right, and you know, on-site contractors, which is listed there, as well as vendors and suppliers listed further down, those are both entities that you have some control over and are entities that are often, in fact, I would say most often, overlooked in the sense of, you know, no agreement is put in place with those folks, even though the very thing that down the road you're going to go to court and say, this is our confidential information, You never actually put anything in place with the vendors or suppliers or other contractors that have come on, and somewhere along the way they get access to it. And if you're on the other side and trying to defeat an injunction, that's a great way to do it, is to poke around in those areas, because those areas are the ones that, you know, a significant number of companies out there just don't have any agreements in place at all that really address or protect the information with those folks. Many companies do, and that's great, but there's an awful lot of that do not. Domestic competitors, you know, same concern as with foreign competitors. The great thing about domestic, though, is that you generally, if you discover that they've got the information, have a better way to go after them legally. And then you have your other folks that we've talked about some as computer hackers. Current employees as well. I mean, you never know, you know, what a current employee may actually be, have a side company and be a competitor, or may have some other reason to have the information or use the information that is not for the best interest of your company.
Randy, let's do this. It's quarter to the hour here, and we've managed to cover about, you know, maybe half of the material so far. Why don't we go to the what efforts are reasonable and then jump to dealing with independent developers to at least, you know, cover that part, that entree in today's feast.
Okay, I'll let you get us to that slide. I'll let you.
Okay. We're going to go to the reasonable efforts. I think that's good to talk about.
Okay, gotcha. Okay.
And then we can jump from there to dealing with independent developers. Nope. You're back that way. There you go. Okay, Randy, take it away.
Okay, as far as what amounts to reasonable efforts, it really varies from case to case, situation to situation, and it doesn't mean in order for something to be a trade secret that the company has had to take every effort, spend every dime to try to do everything in its possible power to cut off, you know, every single way that this information, somebody that's abusing their position or whatever it might be, you know, was able to take it. But nevertheless, you must have taken reasonable efforts. And so many times, you know, the most common way that we can show the courts that we have taken those reasonable efforts are limiting the folks that had it. Access to the information was limited to just those folks that actually needed it to carry out their duties at the employer. Also, the most common is the confidentiality agreements. If you have everyone sign the confidentiality agreements, including the lower level employees, even if those are very generic, then at least you have something in place to show the court that this employee, whoever the employee is, if you've got everybody in the company assigned them, you've got something to show the court that this employee has actually signed an agreement saying that they knew this information was confidential, that they could not use it and could not, you know, provide it to a competitor or take it with them when they left. Some other things that are good practices is, limiting just the way that the everyday life of the employee is carried out such that it's less likely that they're going to have information just sitting around, like have a clean desk policy so that other people that may be in the office or may be in conference rooms where they were, that information doesn't by some strange coincidence leak out to a competitor. Limit the sharing or giving of information to third parties, and if you do, like the vendors or other folks that we've talked about, have agreements in place where that information is protected in those circumstances. And so there's any number of ways, in the regular lives of employees whereby you limit what they do in order to limit their ability to expose or utilize improperly your information. And let's see if I can
get us to
the next slide.
Yep, that's what we're doing up here in Chicago, where we're going to be dealing with independent developers. And this is a situation where, for example, you've gone out, maybe you're dealing with a supplier, and the supplier is somebody that you say, I need you to produce something for me that I don't already have, maybe something that you need to modify or whatever, but make that product for me, which the supplier, of course, is happy to do because they want to supply you with that product. The question, and let's put it in terms of our Acme again. Acme wants new filters. Acme is in the filter business. Acme wants new filters for straining, the yeast that's going to be made. And it commissions Coyote to design and build, those filters which are going to be used to, filter the yeast that it's going to be creating the flavorings from. So it pays for the filters from Coyote as a supplier. That's going to be part of the deal. You build these filters for us, and then we'll buy them for you. Now the question is, time passes. And either the price, is too much, or they want a second supplier, or the relationship is breaking down. And then the question becomes, what happens as a result of that scenario? And in this hypothetical, I did not have any kind of an agreement in place, written or otherwise, as to who owns what rights with respect to these modified filters. So under those kind of circumstances, it can well be that while Acme, owns the filters it bought, it doesn't own the intellectual property that went into those filters. And I've actually litigated these cases where the supplier not only said, no, this is mine, my technology, but went off and patented the technology such that the company that commissioned the product, Acme, now is facing a patent infringement suit, which is a nice way for the supplier to bind, its customers up. So these are not necessarily unusual situations. There are those coyotes out there in the world who, protect themselves, shall we say, by virtue of possessing the intellectual property. So even if Acme thinks that, by commissioning this work, it is the owner of the intellectual property, chances are it isn't the owner of that intellectual property. We all kind of loosely use the terminology of work made for hire, typically perhaps in the copyright context where that comes up. Well, there aren't you know, works made for hire are very specific things. Very easy if you have an employee, but here the topic is the independent developer. So by definition, this is not a regular employee. So in the copyright space, for instance, the work would have to fall into, you know, one of the very limited series of categories that the copyright statute sets forth that can be works made for hire and owned by the author, owned by the commissioning party. And then, as I said, those are very limited in terms of what can fit into those, you know, buckets, those nine buckets of potential works made for hire. And it also has to be in writing. There has to be something signed by, for example, the supplier, Coyote, here, which says, I acknowledge that this is a work made for hire, and therefore you're going to own this work from a copyright standpoint, ACME. Okay, so that's copyright. There's nothing to do with, you know, the patent rights, the trade secret rights that may be involved. You know, perhaps you'll be able to prove a implied contract between ACME and Coyote. If there is no writing, perhaps you end up with at least a limited license to be able to continue to make filters or have somebody else make the filters. But you can see you're in a gray area, a dangerous area. So what you need to do is, you know, as always, try to resolve this and be sure to resolve it up front in a contract, a supply agreement that says, Coyote, you're going to design these filters. And as a result of that design, we, ACME, are going to own all the intellectual property of any kind, of any nature associated with that. Most suppliers are good with that kind of an agreement. But again, sort of like in a joint venture situation. If the supplier is in the business of making filters, for instance, you know, it may say, well, I want to be able to continue to make these filters in the future, or at least use the general skill and knowledge that I have brought to bear or I've learned in the process of making these filters so that I can do this, you know, from here on out. ACME may be willing to do that and allow that, but it may also want some space so that it doesn't end up in competition or its competitors get the rights to, you know, the very filters which it commissioned and intends to own by telling telling Coyote, you can do this, but you're going to have a hiatus of 2 years, 5 years, whatever, before you can, you know, potentially get into, you know, my business of using these filters for whatever. So the supplier-developer case is one that, you know, you must look at, you know, carefully, and must look at, again, at the onset and not try to get into it, you know, as time has devolved, shall we say, and the parties are at cross purposes. So that's at least, you know, a little on the dealing with independent developers aspect of today's discussion. I think what we're going to do is, rather than dealing with independent contract, I'm sorry, dealing with due diligence, which is perhaps now another entirely different scenario. Why don't we return back to the trade secret portion of today's program and talk a little about, you know, the Uniform Trade Secrets Act that are in place in, you know, most states, and Computer Fraud and Abuse Act and the Economic Espionage Act. I think we can do that and finish out our feast for the day. So I'm going to toss it back to you, Randy.
Okay. Great. Yeah, so the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, which was something up to, I don't know, about 10 years ago, I guess, was somewhat spotty and not adopted by almost every state. And now today, it has been, at least some version of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act has been adopted by every state other than New York and Massachusetts. Some say North Carolina has not, but really, if you look at the act in North Carolina, it's almost analogous in many respects. So the nice thing about that is it provides some uniformity, especially for companies that do business in many states. There's some predictability from state to state as to how you know information is going to be treated under the law, because while there may be some slight differences from state to state overall, there's significant similarity as to how trade secrets are thought of and addressed and remedied situations where they're taken. We've talked about, proprietary information and things that rise to the level of a trade secret already. One of the things that the Uniform Trade Secrets Act does is it protects actual and threatened misappropriation. That and threatened part is very important when you're going down to try to get an injunction to protect the company's information. And this is why the many times what happens is the employee has taken the information, they've left. Somebody in the company, usually their manager, has thought, well, something's not exactly right here, or maybe they're just going to a competitor, and so they look anyway and look at their emails or have a forensic analysis done on their laptop to see what kind of activities taken place over the last month. And lo and behold, they find out information has been taken. But then they try to go down there and get an injunction in the court, the employee, prior to the situation where actual threatened misappropriation is also an avenue that's protected, the employee could say, well, actually, I didn't actually use the information, so therefore there's been no actual misappropriation. You can have it back and we're all good. There's no need for an injunction, that sort of thing. And in this situation, that is actually protected, and you get over that hump anyway because they have it, they have the information, they could use it. Some states have transformed this provision into meaning that the inevitable disclosure doctrine. I won't get into the great details of that, but essentially an employee who doesn't have a non-compete but goes somewhere and has confidential information in their mind or in their hand or essentially is going into a situation, an analogous position at a competitor where there's no way they can carry out their job duties there without using it, then perhaps they could get injunctive relief and keep that employee from going there. That those are hard arguments to make, but sometimes successful. And in some states, this in threatened misappropriation has been used in that situation. And of course, provides injunctive relief in addition to damages. So on their front end, you can get a get an order from the court, a restraining order, and then a temporary injunction saying, the employee cannot, use or disclose the information, and maybe even if there's a non-compete, cannot work for this competitor. And if there's on the back end, if there has been some use that, before you got your injunction in place, you've already been damaged, you can go in and recover your damages. And one of the biggest things, and certainly in many states such as Texas, the biggest change that the adoption of a version of the Uniform Trade Secrets Act has had is the addition of being able to get your attorney's fees. Misappropriation of trade secrets lawsuits are traditionally more on the expensive side. Especially if you've got a situation where there's a significant number of employees or a significant amount of information involved. And so being able to get your attorney's fees back from all of that is a big deal. And that's been very important to many clients over the last few years as far as that part of it, the ability to get your attorney's fees back. And we've already talked a little bit just a moment ago about the inevitable disclosure doctrine and how it works, so I won't go into much more detail on that. I do want to mention, we just got a minute or two left. There are a number of acts out there that you can use in these situations. Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, very important. The nice thing about it is it's not only limited to trade secrets, also gets you into federal court if you want to be in federal court. The next one, the Economic Espionage Act, big thing here. It's actually a federal crime to steal trade secrets. And while in practice that's not all that often carried out, it is in the appropriate circumstance and can be something else the employer looks to. So, Mike, I could run through all of these but rather than do that, do we want to address any questions or anything else? We're about out of time.
We are, but there were a couple of questions that were that came up, and one comment, and maybe we'll just take the comment first. It looks like one of perhaps our California listeners points out a scenario where labeling somebody as an independent contractor as providing a work made for hire, using that terminology in an agreement, for example, could expose the company to tax liability. You know, that this employee is going to be treated under, you know, California law for tax purposes. So that's an interesting point to be raised. Another question that was actually posed related to the JV situation, the joint venture situation, and the question asked, what do you do in a situation where, you know, you may have employees from one or both sides that are contributing to this joint venture? How do you necessarily deal with those employees? And I've typically, you know, in the situations that I've been involved in with these, they remain the employees of, you know, Acme on the one hand, Roadrunner on the other. And the parties just make sure that there are provisions in place that are going to assure that, you know, one or the other party can enforce the employee agreements, assuming they're in place, the employee agreements of the other party as to that particular employee. Because ordinarily, the employee of Acme is not going to necessarily want to be an employee also of the joint venture. That can get extremely messy with respect to, you know, sorting out, you know, employees as to who they work for, et cetera. But again, that's kind of the complexity of what sounds like a very simple deal, which is, hey, we want to do this deal and get it done and become, you know, filthy rich in the process, shall we say. It's not all that easy, at least in terms of the documentation. So I think that brings us to the end of this session. We will perhaps be able to set up in the future a session that is going to include or be entirely devoted to the due diligence aspect of you know, mergers and acquisitions in terms of the intellectual property. That's one of the courses of this feast that we were not able to get to today. So with that, Randy and I will thank everyone for you know, listening in. And, you know, perhaps we'll see you again.
Great. Thank you so much. This concludes today's webinar. Thank you for attending.